37. Arthi. Arthi reached under the desk and pulled out the real ledger. Its violet ribbon looked almost exactly like the replica she had tucked into the book Laith had pocketed before he was dragged away. Get behind me. She had the ledger at last, but she could barely summon triumph. She couldn't stop repeating that moment in her head, when Laith's alarm and fear morphed into the realization that she had betrayed him. It was him or her. And yet, he hadn't done the same to her. He hadn't said a word when the vampires apprehending him had asked him if he was here alone. He hadn't even looked angry, only heartbroken. He'd taken the fall and the false ledger, and now he would die. Arthi pulled on the lever, and the vault door slid open again with a forlorn sigh. She snapped her pocket watch closed. Jin would arrive any moment now. No sooner had the thought crossed her mind than the office door swung open. She saw Jin first, then Flick. Both of them had been expected. She hadn't expected Mateo, blonde and pale and almost ghostly, and certainly not the figure before them, a vampire with a trim beard and dark shoulder-length hair tied at the base of his skull. He had a cravat set with a ruby knotted at his throat and a gold hoop in his right ear that glinted in the lamplight. For this very reason, the plan had always been to leave before the auction concluded. But it couldn't have been over yet. Not unless Mateo. She should have known he would do this. Arthi faced him. Pen. He smiled at her. Hello, daughter. Arthi caught a whiff of the cigar in his hand, and she was 8 again, standing on his ebony doorstep, while silver needles of rain pelted the cobblestones, clouds heavy and grey. Her cheeks were still stained with the death of her parents, blood still crusted under her nails. I'm not your daughter, she said, forcing herself back to the present. The firelight lit his half-Arawian skin. She used to envy anyone who could pass as a Peaky before she realized such a wish was a betrayal to herself. The easy route was never for her. You were the only one who came close. Good word. Look at you, Pen said, almost surprised, as he closed the door behind him. His voice made her feel safe and comfortable. Two illnesses she never allowed herself to catch again. Please, please, please. Jin made a sound in his throat. It seemed she was betraying everyone tonight. She had meant to tell him when they'd first found each other. It would have been easier to process the horror in his face when he learned the truth, to watch him pull away and disappear forever. But later became tomorrow, and tomorrow became next month, and next month became a decade. Arthi loved secrets, but love was a feeling much like hate. So full, so heavy, so laden with everything. And for all the secrets she collected, she hated her own. She loved Jin in a way she could never speak aloud, in a way that made her feel weak and foolish, in a way no one but he loved her back. She hadn't wanted that to end. But one secret had slowly become another, each tangling with the last. And when he looked at her now, she realized that somewhere along the way, she had pushed him away herself. All that talk of your parents dying in Salan, he said, the words rushing out of him in a mix of anger and hurt. It was... True, Arthi finished. Pen took me in for about a year after I got to Atenia. Before you, I've never lied to you, Jin.
No,
Jin agreed mockingly. You only left out just about everything. Pen set his cigar on an ashtray and swiveled the mirrors on his desk, sealing his vault back into obscurity. I'm afraid I can't let you leave. Jin huffed a laugh. Oh, we're leaving all right. And how do you intend to do that? Pen asked, tilting his head to the door. You step out of this office, and you will die, just as your friend soon will.
Which friend? Flick asked, searching about the room. Arthi, where's Laith?
Jin looked at Arthi. He was the only one who knew she had never intended for Laith to leave with them. There was that guilt again, knotting her tongue and stifling her conscience.
He was apprehended, Pen answered.
Arthi was lucky enough to have been sealed in the vault.
Lucky enough.
It wasn't luck that had saved her, but her own quick thinking. Arthi would have been insulted if she didn't feel so horrible.
Oh, Arthi, Flick breathed, whirling to face her. I'm so sorry. You must be devastated.
Arthi was irked that Flick thought she might be more devastated than the rest of them.
There are rules that must be followed, Pen said sternly. Break them, and there are repercussions. Now give me the ledger, and tell me what this is about, little lion.
A memory rose in the quiet. Her hands bloody, her skirts dripping red. He had drawn her against his side despite the mess of blood. She clutched the ledger tight to her chest.
The ram has too much power, and we're going to challenge it, Flick said, stepping to Arthi's side.
Jin stepped to Arthi's other side. She could tell he was angry and hurt, that he had an endless list of questions to ask her, but his presence gave her comfort.
It's the only way to save Spindrift.
A knock sounded at the door.
Come in, Pen called.
Someone new entered the room.
I've apprehended the intruders. Don't look at them, look at me.
Placate our guests and resume the festivities. The vampire nodded and finally left, and Pen turned to address Arthi.
You and your friends have caused quite a stir, and exponentially increased the value of my work, said Matteo.
Don't talk, Jin snapped. Don't pretend to be one of us.
Matteo looked at him coolly. As if I was in search of a reason to disgrace myself.
Open the ledger, Pen said. A line jumped in his jaw. Arthi slipped the ledger from its case and flipped it open. There were notes, but it was mainly an account, tracking exports and imports and commodities. She flipped to the page marked by the ribbon. It was the same export, over and over again. The first few hadn't gone far before being returned. Flick read over Arthi's shoulder.
What's an EJC corpus? Are these weapons?
Atenia lacked the resources to produce anything on a large scale.
It was why they dug their claws into places like Salan for tea and cinnamon, Juvent Gar for spices and textiles, Kirilan for silk and opium, far off Marubia for gold and ivory. In many ways, the East Juvent Company was as bad as the ram.
Pen's voice was tight.
Of a sort. Starve the lion long enough, and no force can vanquish him. By my definition, that makes one a weapon, doesn't it?
Starve? Flick asked with a frown. I thought we were talking about the EJC's exports.
Pen picked up his cigar. His face was grave when he nodded.
We are. The exports are vampires.
38. Flick. Flick was still getting over the fact that they'd broken into the Aetherium and lost one of their crew. And now she had to wrap her head around the idea of vampires being the cargo listed on that ledger. As if they could be fitted into crates like weapons and sent across the sea. By her mother's company, no less.
Why? Jin asked, his arms crossed.
Flick could tell he had his emotions on a leash. At its most distilled level, hatred. Because fear unchecked too often festers into loathing. It's easy to look at the errors of a few and blame an entire kind, Pen replied.
But why destroy when you can utilize? Place a starved vampire in a battlefield, and what choice do they have but to feed? Their only concern is staving off that hunger. They'll attack anything with a pulse. What is a monster if not a man pushed to the brink? Matteo murmured. Arthie looked grave. Weapons on a mass scale with none of the cost. Much like the Peakies, forcefully enlisting Giovanni and Silani to fight against their own in Atenian wars, Jin said. Penn tilted his head. If the reason for the Atenians' animosity toward any minority in this country could be compared to vampires, then yes. But those are people. Vampires are predators. So this is why vampires have been going missing. None of this could be possible without help from the inside. Jin said, from the vampires themselves. Penn nodded. From the Aetherium as well. For many, aiding the Ram and the EJC is their only security against being taken, while others are simply looking for a cut. I can't fully blame them, for I've lost some of my best vampires. Arthie laughed bitterly. If the EJC is transporting them to the battlefields, then it's making a cut itself. Flick sat down in one of the armchairs by the hearth, letting the warmth of the fire sink into her bones. As frightening as vampires were, Flick didn't think they ought to be drugged and used. Even in the throes of hunger, when whatever innate vampiric instincts took over, like with Matteo on his porch, they were still conscious of their actions. She tried to imagine being driven by a blinding hunger, trapped inside her own body as she tore through masses of people. No one deserved such horror. Matteo turned to her. Mummy's been a very bad lady. Flick sank deeper into her chair. She knew the EJC wasn't entirely clean, but this was beyond acceptable. And as she sat there, she felt like a kettle left too long on the stove. All her insides were roiling, raging and bubbling out, hot and angry. Jin tossed his jacket on the back of the other chair, whose exhale was heavy with the decision. Let's go back to the beginning, shall we? Starting with how you, Mr. Penn, know everything, and why we should trust you. You might have taken Arthie in a decade ago, but that's plenty of time for a man to go dirty. The beginning? Penn asked with a laugh. Very well. It began with an expedition. My father was a Tenian, but my mother was a Rawian and an adventurer. More so after his passing. She was eager to join the voyage to Atenia, and so I accompanied her on the trade ship that was carrying artifacts of immense value, and not the monetary kind. Sentimental, then? Flick suggested. Not quite. Arawia is a kingdom of enchantment. There is magic in the very land beneath their feet, fueling conjurers of flame, hunters capable of finding anything they set their hearts to. Dreamwalkers, healers who can stitch wounds with a touch. Penn continued wistfully. The kingdom was cursed to isolation in recent years. But even before that, magic was limited to Arawia alone. Stand on enchanted land, and you may borrow a bit of its magic. Leave Arawian soil, and any affinity you have will no longer work, except in the case of Hylia. Artifacts charged with magic and memory, capable of immense, immeasurable power. Flick saw Arthie's gaze light up in recognition. They can be used anywhere, with the right words, Penn said. Creation has since been forbidden, but in the old days, when Arawia was at its cusp, they were traded to the kingdom's advantage. Flick sensed an until somewhere in his story. Jin and Arthie listened keenly, albeit warily. Matteo, on the other hand, looked as if he'd heard the story before and poured himself a glass of blood from a decanter opposite Penn's fireplace. My mother and I boarded that ship, along with several of the ruling sister's trusted immortals.
Were they vampires? Arthi asked.
Mateo waved a hand. They're elven. Immortal. Vain. Think they're better because they've seen it all.
Sounds familiar, she said pointedly.
He lifted his glass at her.
Can we go back to our bedtime story, please?
Jin asked.
I should like that, Pen said, amused.
Our ship docked here in White Roaring, and I remember thinking it fitting that the skies were so wan and grey in a way Arawiyas were not. For my mother was frailer than ever. The days crawled by and her condition worsened. Hygiene was not commonplace here. Soap was almost impossible to procure. Not long later, she passed. Flick noted the way he spoke the words, unaffected and unafflicted. There were days when she missed her mother, as if they had been parted by death, not a wing of their estate. I buried her myself. The same evening, we learned one of the Arawian elves hadn't been so trustworthy. One of the Hylia was a glass heart, filled with what was argued to be blood. He thought he could make a profit of his own. And in the midst of trading the piece, it shattered. Without the right incantation, a Hylia cannot be used. But no one knew the procedure for one that broke, disappearing into the land itself, too far from the one that birthed it.
Let me guess. The immortals said it would be fine, Arthi said.
Pen nodded. It created some twisted mutation of magic. We were by the graveyard when it happened. Corpses started rising from the dirt. To be a vampire, one must be turned within seconds after death, before the heart and brain ceased to fully function. These weren't vampires, but ghouls. The same concept, but they were heartless and brainless, possessing nothing but an endless hunger. He looked down at his desk as if he could see his past in the smoke from his cigar. My mother was one of them. She attacked me, and what sort of son would injure his own mother in turn? Before I knew it, darkness was tipping into my vision. The others were shouting. The ghouls were letting loose, terrible, throaty growls. They pried her away from me, but I couldn't move. I was so overcome with emotion at the sight of what she had become that I wished for physical pain. More of it. Anything to distract from the pain of having to see her die again. Another corpse attacked from behind, squeezed my windpipe. I was dying. And at some point in those few seconds before my death, I drank blood. I don't know whose, or how they even had blood when they'd been dead so long. But when Ahilia was involved, anything was possible. I woke up a vampire. I hadn't known what I was, only that I hadn't been dead long enough to become a ghoul. I was as terrified as the others were, and to this day, I cannot fault them for attacking me in turn. And no one can fault a body for its innate sense of self-defense. You've heard of vampires that wake with powers, yes? I had the power to make others feel pain with nothing but my mind. It was an illusion. In the midst of their screams, I realized they were imagining pain, that their bones were breaking or their spine was snapping. Flick stared at Pen, the crinkles by his eyes from an eternity of smiling, the compassion in his gaze from an age of understanding. More and more, it seemed that every person she met had something terrible in their past. Whether they'd seen it or inflicted it, everyone walked with a burden. That very power has seen me through the decades. Not the use of it, because I'm no monster, but the rumor alone, Pen said, then laughed. When the wolf of White Roaring went on his rampage, I was asked to establish the Aetherium and helped craft the vampire-human laws we have in place. It did little to appease the public's fear of vampires, and the monarch was too busy scrambling. Not long after, We had a new one. Who knew exactly what the people wanted?
What are you getting at? Arthi asked.
The Wolf of White Roaring attack was fabricated in order to instill fear. Penn said. Vampires had lived in relative secrecy for decades. Until the Ram decided otherwise, forcefully turning the Wolf of White Roaring into a half-vampire and unleashing him upon the city so that the Ram could sweep in and save it. But no one knew that was only the beginning.
39. Arthi.
The Ram controlled the chaos to gain the people's favour, Arthi said. Just when she thought the government couldn't get any worse, the Ram had found a way. Pacify the people to keep them in check, and no one notices you furthering your own agenda. First power, now profit, Jin said, disgust dripping from his tone. Arthi didn't know how the Ram had managed to work in a personal cut in the deal between the government and the trading company, but here they were. Flick looked as if she was sick to her stomach.
Felicity, are you all right? Jin asked.
She rubbed at her chest, her gaze distant. Arthi snapped her fingers. Flick! Flick looked up with a gasp.
What do you do when you're angry?
Her voice was tight, and the way she asked the question made Arthi think the emotion was foreign to her. Arthi understood. I let it fuel me and everything that I do. But it's important to note the difference between fuel and dictate. Flick nodded. Half to herself, deep in thought.
Jin looked up from the ledger.
What does this mean? He asked, taking it to Penn. The Ram's been logging each transaction with some sort of shot. The earlier ones failed, but the later ones have had a good success rate.
Penn drummed a quick hand on the desk.
They discovered a way to formulate silver into an inoculation for the betterment of the human population. But silver is detrimental to a vampire's physique. Inject them, and they're immobilized for long enough to starve and seal in a crate and ship off to the front lines. They knew the stories of the Wolf of White Roaring, of the horrific attacks that cropped up from time to time across Atenia. A vampire starved beyond reason was a machine with a single purpose: carnage. A second half dose is administered just before the drop point, Penn continued, so that once the vampire reaches the battlefront, they will ravage the enemy until either the vampire or the soldiers are overcome.
Despicable, Matteo said.
Penn tilted his head. Atenians were being enlisted, and vampires refused to do the same. We are predators, and refuse to partake in unfair wars spurred by colonization, and the country capitalized on that. Refusing to take no for an answer was certainly a peaky thing to do.
We always knew the ledger was damning, Arthi said to the others. Nothing has changed, and so long as we have it, the Ram won't know peace.
Nor will we, Jin pointed out. We came here to retrieve the ledger and save Spindrift. I warned you that this would be bigger than us. The fireplace crackled in the silence, spurred by his words. It stretched shadows across the room, lengthening already concerned faces and heating the atmosphere of dread.
I'm afraid I can't let you have it.
The ledger is the only proof I have in the case I'm building, Penn said. I'm waiting on leads to a few of the vampires who've gone missing before I appeal to the court.
Appeal? Jin repeated with an incredulous laugh. Are you serious?
If the Ram could fabricate his way to a crown, I doubt the evidence you gather will go anywhere. He was right. They were weaponizing vampires. Arthi didn't think proof would make a lick of a difference. There were too many variables in his plan, and almost all of them ended with the ledger being destroyed. You are young and jaded, and in many ways correct. But some of us refuse to use unethical avenues. Penn gestured to a leather folio on his desk. If I have enough proof, they'll be unable to refute it. As such, I've also uncovered a lead to the laboratory where the scientists first produced the silver doses.
Wait, Jin said, a hush to his voice. Scientists?
Pen nodded. Old friends of mine. And then he tossed Jin a clove rock.
40. Jin. Jin caught the candy and the life drained out of him. It was him. Pen was their weekly visitor who had argued with Jin's father the night before the fire. Jin made a sound that was half laugh, half sob, and all hope. You've always known they were alive, he chastised himself. But believing his 11-year-old self had gotten difficult as the years went by. Do you want to know a secret? His father would say whenever he and his mother were in the thick of their research. They would tell Jin of their findings, but make him promise not to tell anyone else, because they weren't proven yet. They'd spoken of coconuts and transfusions, nerve endings and viruses, but he'd never once heard them talk of a silver inoculation. A hand touched his back, Flick reminding him to breathe. I'm sorry, Jin, Pen said. Jin almost laughed. 10 years, and no one had ever expressed their condolences for what had happened. No one besides Arthur even knew, or knew enough to care, really. Do we know if they still live? Arthur asked. Pen worked his jaw. Not for certain. They've been missing ever since they formulated the inoculation. It's been years. There's every likelihood that they are. No. Arthur thought on it for a moment and shook her head. The ram is too smart to waste a resource. A resource. That was what his parents had become. Not a mother and a father and a friend and a loved one, but yet another commodity for the ram to exploit. Everyone was staring at him. Let the poor boy be, Mateo said. Jin looked everywhere and then finally at Arthur. He was supposed to be mad at her. We haven't learned anything new. I'd always known they were alive, and now I'm just hearing it from someone else. Spindrift first. Arthur hid a smile, and he knew then he wasn't the only one who'd held out hope about them being alive. Knowing her, she would have kept quiet about it to give him less hope, in case the worst was really true. Spindrift first, Arthur repeated with a nod. Then she turned to Pen. Gathering proof doesn't guarantee the court will listen. Jin tried to focus on the conversation and quell his racing pulse. He was grateful to Arthur for redirecting the conversation, but also selfishly wished they could dwell on it a little more. His parents. Alive. Arthur was still talking. We don't know how many of them work for the ram. Pen smiled. We? Arthur faltered, and Jin saw her uncertainty. In the decade he'd been by her side, Jin had rarely seen Arthur hesitate. Nor did she ever involve herself in anything outside of the wrath she wanted to enact. The world was full of suffering, she would say, and it wasn't her job to fix it. Yes, she said to Pen, meeting his eyes with finality. This is my problem too, now. Our problem, Jin corrected. We're bound to have dirt on some of the officials. We can coerce enough of them to see Penn's case through. And I might be able to get you a court roster, Flick offered. Jin and Arthur exchanged a glance. Spindrift was founded on blackmail and threats. It only made sense that they would save it using the same. 41. Arthur. Exiting the Aetherium was a much easier affair when Pen escorted Arthur and the others through the halls like they were royalty. On the street just outside the gates, Arthur inhaled the night breeze. The night had deepened, and in the darkness, she let her thoughts crash, one after the next. Laith and his words before he was taken away. Jin and the betrayal in his eyes as he left her to walk home alone. Flick and the secret she was bursting at the seams to spill.
Penn warning them that Spindrift might no longer be safe. His offer to relocate them to his house on Imperial Square only rubbed salt on the wound. White Roaring carried on as if nothing had changed. Loam carriages trundled, pleasure house doors slammed shut on rusty hinges. Coins jangled in the hands of workers after a long day. It was only Arthi's view of the world that had sustained another crack from a hammer since she'd broken into the Ethereum. Weaponizing vampires, people, for all intents and purposes, wasn't an ignorable evil. Nor was leaving someone for dead. There was that guilt, coiling thick in her throat. If she hadn't stepped back into the vault, she would be sitting with Laith in that cell right now. If the vampires hadn't burst through Penn's door first, Laith might have slit her throat. Or he might not have. Get behind me. The words haunted her every step, trundling in her ears like this wretched carriage beside her. Was there no other road in the city? Arthi shot a glare at the wagon's unmarked covering and turned down another street. Suddenly certain she'd seen the same pair of horses lingering outside the Ethereum when she and Jin had gone their separate ways. She paused and listened. Silence. The carriage hadn't followed her. She was being paranoid. She started walking again and heard the neigh of a horse, followed by the sound of wheels rolling over cobblestone. Drat it all. Arthi ran her hand over her pistol and walked straight into the middle of the street, forcing the carriage to a halt. She held her hat against a gust of wind and circled past the horses, eyeing the driver as she went. He didn't look her way, nor did she recognize him. If Jin was here, he'd give her 1,000 different warnings as she marched to the door of the carriage. But she'd spent the last few hours breaking into the Ethereum. A carriage was nothing. She had a latch lift inside and thought fleetingly about the vampires being kidnapped. The door swung open to a yawning pit of darkness. No one emerged, nor did any sound. Arthi touched her pistol again and stepped inside. Arthi Casimir. The voice was modulated, muffled by something in front of the speaker's mouth. Like a mask. And there's the first reason I should kill you, Arthi said. You've been following me since Ivy Lock Street. What you want?
You have something of mine,
said the voice. Arthi tilted her head and narrowed her eyes. You'll have to be more specific. She heard a shuffle, and the figure leaned into the moonlight, illuminating a gilded mask, shadows pooling into the pits of its eyes. The ram. Fear dropped like a stone inside of her.
My ledger.
Are you demanding or bargaining? Arthi asked, willing her voice to remain calm.
Give me the ledger, and you can keep your establishment.
That's mighty generous of you, but it was my establishment until you threatened my proprietor, Arthi said. Wearing a mask doesn't make you a better liar. There would be no end, Arthi knew, even if she handed over the ledger. It was as Laith had said. The ram disliked Spindrift, and as long as Spindrift existed, the threat to it would remain. For as long as the ram existed, the threat would remain. This wasn't only about Spindrift anymore. She couldn't be a thorn in the ram's side anymore. She needed the ram gone. For herself, for her crew, and for the vampires being snatched for a war that wasn't theirs.
My ledger for Spindrift,
the ram repeated, and the carriage door swung open again. Arthi stepped down, the weight of her pistol heavy at her side. If only it was as easy as firing a bullet through that pathetic mask. 42. Flick. Flick tried to see the best in everything. If that couldn't be done, she was sad or indifferent. Never angry, or rather, never this angry. This was rage. She'd spent the entire night tossing and turning in her room at Spindrift. She couldn't forge a signet ring or a document or even a doctor's note without being treated like a dirty criminal. But her mother could do this? There was a voice in the back of Flick's head that said Lady Lyndon might not know. The EJC was large, and there could be any number of supervisors looking to make extra profit on the side. But louder than that voice was the certainty that her mother did know. And that was how Flick found herself standing in front of the Lyndon estate on Admiral Grove in the early hours of the next day. The trees were going bare, their leaves lightly carpeting the cobblestones in gold. Amid that rustle and dry tumble, Flick thought she heard another sound, the whisper of small footsteps, the crunch of a shoe across leaves. When she whirled around to look, no one was there. "Chester?" she called. "Felix?" No one replied. "Stop looking for excuses," she chided herself, and marched up to the basil green door of the estate, ignoring the quiver of her fingers when she rapped with the iron knocker. It looked stately before, but now it reminded Flick of the horns of a devil. The door swung open and immediately closed again, leaving only a sliver of space through which Flick could see a brown eye surrounded by full lashes. Her mother only hired the prettiest.
"Miss Felicity," the young maid stammered out.
Flick held herself together. "Act like you belong. I need to see my mother." The maid paused at her tone, and Flick peeked inside. Nothing seemed any different than when she'd lived there.
I, of course, miss. It's just that I don't know if..."
"Now," Flick enunciated.
"Yes, of course," said the maid, brown hair bobbing with her nod. "She's in her office."
Flick took several deep breaths and dipped her hands into the pockets of her periwinkle wool coat to grip her lighter. Then she tugged her beret tight over her curls and stepped inside her house, hurrying up the winding stairs. She threw open the door to her mother's study without a knock.
"Felicity."
Her mother's surprise was punctuated by her pen rolling to a stop against a stack of books. Lady Lyndon stared at Flick from behind her oak desk. Her remarkable cerulean eyes filled with shock. She was dressed in a gown she typically reserved for business, a fathomless shade of blue with fitted sleeves that flared from the elbows, and lace that folded at her throat. It made her look regal and commanding.
What are you doing here?"
Lady Lyndon asked. Was it the light streaming in through the shuttered windows behind her, or did she appear annoyed? Her daughter, who had been arrested and supposedly was now rotting in a cell, had returned, and she had the audacity to look vexed. Flick straightened her beret. She was so caught up in her anger and wanting to confront her mother that she hadn't thought about what to say. It's important to note the difference between fuel and dictate. She wasn't being dictated by her rage. It wasn't all-encompassing. She missed the cedarwood scent of her mother's office. She missed having tea and biscuits every evening in front of the wide windows facing the garden. She missed the sharp, sophisticated lines of her mother's gowns. The harsh crease across her mother's brow softened. "Why did you do it?" Flick asked. "I loved you, Felicity, but you did this to yourself," she said with a resigned sigh. Loved. Was that in the past tense? She didn't hear it over the thundering in her ears. But there was something to be said about children and their knack for knowing. Flick knew her mother's love had been real. What she hadn't known was that parents could stop loving their children and tire of them the way someone tired of a pair of shoes. It didn't matter how much wrong Flick had done. It didn't matter that she'd made mistakes, spurred by her mother's growing distaste for her. No matter what, Flick was her daughter. She clutched her lighter as if etched somewhere in the brass was the reason why she had gone from her mother's little spark to a stranger. But this wasn't about Flick. "I'm talking about what you've done," Flick said, and it took everything in her not to recoil at the anger twisting her mother's face because of her tone. "Oh, I need to be more specific, don't I?" Her mother's neat blonde bun was dull, and new wrinkles were carved into her skin. Was it because she'd been worried about Flick? Or did she know the Ram's ledger had gone missing and that word of her involvement could spread? "You will not speak to... How did you get out of prison?" "I was never in it, Mother," Flick snapped, "which you might have known if you'd come to check on me." Lady Lyndon looked like she'd been slapped, but Flick wasn't finished. "How could you partake in something so evil? How could you treat vampires like any other cargo on your ships?" Her mother froze, but recovered quickly. She rose, towering over her. Flick used to feel safe in her shadow. Now she felt a quiver of fear. Fear. That was why she'd rarely experienced anger. She'd never been allowed to. She was always afraid to. Afraid to speak out, to feel anything but gratitude and appreciation and happiness. It was funny how she'd spent over a week with Arthi and Jin, running the streets and breaking into the Ethereum of all places, and the fear she'd experienced then was entirely different. Exhilarating. It had felt like living. "Where did you hear of this?" her mother asked. There was no remorse on her face. No shame. Only cold assessment. This was business to her. Nothing else. A transaction. Flick cracked a sad, sad laugh. "And to think I wanted to give you the benefit of the doubt. To think I was ready to do anything for your forgiveness." She was ready to steal that ledger from under Arthi's nose, risking Spindrift, risking her alliances, risking Jin, just to give her mother the front page of every paper in White Roaring, in a tenure even. Just for her mother to love her again. "Answer the question, girl," Lady Lyndon snapped. "Or what?" Flick asked, a bit of Arthi creeping into her voice. "You'll confine me to my room?" "No, I think I'll take my leave, Mother." Flick turned to leave. She knew her mother would ring for help. But Flick had learned a thing or two from Jin. She'd disconnected the wire on her way in. "That won't be necessary," Flick said, as Lady Lyndon reached for the cord. "I know the way out. This is my house, after all." She had a few extra seconds to spare, which was more than enough time to leave her brass lighter on her mother's desk and close the door behind her. Act 3. A Fire in Slumber. 43. Jin. It took Jin a few moments to remember he was in Spindrift when he woke the next morning. He'd dreamed of his house on Admiral Grove, his mother talking about certitudes, and his father talking about theories. Still, when he tumbled out of bed, it wasn't with the optimism at having outsmarted a foe or the excitement of a possible lead to his parents, but dread. He didn't even get to bask in the comfort of being back in Spindrift again. Something felt wrong. He knocked on Flick's door, and it swung open beneath his knuckles. The room was empty. His brow furrowed. Strange. The doors to Spindrift flung open downstairs before Jin could think more on it, and he hurried to the balcony. Arthi stood at the threshold, and he wished her every emotion didn't bleed into him. He wished she didn't look unkempt and wild, warning him that something was wrong. "Get everyone to Imperial Square," she said. She was breathless. Jin wasted no time. He crossed the balcony and tugged on the rope, ringing the bell to alert the others. Arthi's panic became his, and then everyone else's, as urgency swept Spindrift's wooden walls. Doors flung open across the tea room. Jin darted down the stairs to meet her.
What happened?
The ram knows we don't plan to hand over the ledger, Arthi said. Jin swallowed a laugh. What had been the point of breaking into the Ethereum? Of everything they'd risked their necks for?
What about my things?
Chester shouted, swinging his blanket from the upstairs balcony. He shrank back at Arthi's look.
We're coming back, Jin said gently, ushering him down.
The boy brought his blanket anyway, telling Rennie he trusted no one. They all had a little bit of Arthi in them.
You, get word to Matteo Andoni on Arm's place, Arthi ordered someone. The rest of you, leave in groups. Don't need a row of ducks waddling 10 blocks over.
Jin rounded the flip top and pulled out a box from under the counter.
How do you know?
I met the ram last night. Felix saw men mobilizing this morning. Cold dread settled in his limbs and he nearly dropped his umbrella.
You met? We don't have time for this, she said in a low hiss. Has anyone seen Flick?
Her door was open, Jin said with a shake of his head. No one's seen her. The ram would not be so bold as to utilize the horned guard to attack them, but there were plenty of others who hated them. Plenty waiting for an excuse. The ram only had to point, and one of White Roaring's gangs would rise to the occasion with cheer.
Find her, Arthi ordered. I want to know where she's been.
Somewhere behind the kitchens, a window shattered. Everyone stopped. Jin wished he was asleep, and this was all a bad dream. He wished he could roll over and leap into a new one with pastries and candies. Arthi moved first. She turned to Chester and shoved a map in his hands.
You remember the house on Imperial Square, don't you? It's a safe house. Knock and tell the housekeeper Penn would like hot chocolate with his pie, then they'll let you in. I'm counting on you, eh?
Good boy.
Three sinister shadows fell across the frosted glass doors, each holding something long and wicked.
Plodders, Jin said. They were the only gang who couldn't afford guns. They weren't the brightest of the lot either, but they made up for it in brute force. The sudden silence inside Spindrift was starker than a gunshot. Arthi swept a look across their crew.
Line up against the wall by the entrance. At Jin's signal, file out.
Then she squared her shoulders and threw open the doors. The plodders were dressed like the streets they ran, a terrible shade of brown, like they'd rolled about in mud before showing face. Faded trousers, ratty sashes, dusty bowler caps, yellow collars bright. Arthi feigned surprise, taking several steps back to draw them inside. Jin waited until the plodders cleared the entrance, then gave Chester a nod. He squeezed past them and through the doors, grabbing hold of the hand behind him, each of them doing the same until a plodder turned around and broke the line, throwing the new girl to the ground. Several more plodders trundled inside and slammed the doors shut before anyone else could escape.
Boys and girl, Jin said, inclining his head.
He swung his umbrella up to his shoulder beside Arthi.
Long time, no trouble.
The leader of the gang, Davison, tapped a bat against his open palm. He looked half drunk.
Let me guess. Someone told you there was a party to be had,
Arthi said, pulling back the panel of her jacket to flash her pistol at him. Davison swayed.
I've always wanted to wipe those smirks off your faces. Now I'm getting paid to do it.
Arthi reached for the teapot Jin had set down on the counter earlier.
Might I interest you in a cup of tea first?
He only stared blankly, then jerked his head. His filthy lock converged. Arthi swung the teapot, shattering it against Davison's head before she grabbed him by the scruff of his jacket and swept the counter with his face, teacups shattering, teaspoons scattering. She threw him at the bricked column, where he struck his head and fell.
Pitiful fellow.
Jin sighed.
You didn't have to go and ruin my favourite tea set.
You said that about the last one too,
Arthi replied, straightening her jacket. The rest of the plodders looked at one another.
Oh, don't look so disappointed, lads, Jin placated. Plenty of tea to go round.
He picked up a stack of saucers.
Fancy some biscuits too. You can't come into our home and expect us not to treat you with proper Casimir hospitality.
The plodders came at them all at once. Jin moved toward the tables, flinging saucers at throats and shoving chairs out of his way. A plodder lunged when Jin's stack ran out, and he swung his umbrella, toppling him with a calculated strike to his leg. He kicked another plodder out of the way and swung for the third one's hand, but the girl grabbed the end of his umbrella and yanked it out of Jin's grip.
Gently, gently,
he chided when it struck the wall. She lashed out with a wicked knife dulled with rust and dirt. Jin swerved, and when she lashed again with startling speed, he grabbed a chair and threw it up as a shield. The force of her arc drove the knife through the seat, snapping the wood in two, but not before Jin slammed it, and the end of her blade, downward through her thigh. He cringed. That was going to leave a mark. A burly plodder came at him with another knife, and Jin whipped out his own, landing a strike that bought him time to whirl the fellow against his body when yet another one came at him with a club. The club struck the plodder on the head, knocking him out cold, and Jin rammed his knife between the other's ribs as a thank you. Jin tugged the knife free, tossing the club up and into his hand. Much obliged.
Jin!
Arthur yelled. His blood spiked, and he nearly tripped when he ran, flinging the club at another plodder. But after all this time, he should have known he didn't need to worry about Arthi. He found her bashing the heads of two plodders together, both far taller and larger than she was. In the beat of calm, she wiped a smear of blood from her cheek, her eyes wild and cold in a way that gave Jin pause.
Get the others out,
she said, her voice strained. He stepped closer.
I'm not leaving you here.
I didn't ask.
Neither did I.
Arthi leaped back and thrust her knife into a plodder's gut with one hand, hurling it at another in the same move. She clenched her jaw as if struck, swaying as if she were losing blood. Something was wrong. He started toward her before he jerked to a halt at a sound he knew well. Too bloody well. A hiss, a sputtering whoosh. Fire. Flames ripped across the counters where rags had been stretched to dry. Terror struck every part of him, held him captive. The fire crackled, roared, reached with angry protests. No, not Spindrift. The adrenaline from the fight disappeared, leaving only stone-cold dread. Arthi fought to get by his side.
Breathe, Jin.
He opened his mouth and a sound came out. He couldn't form words. He couldn't think past the chant in his head.
Fire, fire, fire. Stay calm,
Arthi hissed in his ear. She was struggling. Why was she struggling? She didn't fear fire the way he did. With a growl, she turned away. Her knife caught the light as she lobbed it again, then she nabbed his and disappeared. Through his tunneling vision, he saw her parry a plodder double her size. Get the others out, she had said. He swallowed. He could do that. He rubbed at the scarred skin of his arm, breathed past the claws digging into his chest, dropped to his knees and scrambled for his umbrella, tightening his fist around it after what felt like forever. He turned to the others pressed against the shadows. Rennie was bent over a plodder, his fangs in the man's neck. A couple of the others were helping Arthi. Jin threw open the doors.
Too slow. Too slow.
He ushered the others out, counting heads, then losing track and counting them again. He lifted one of the younger ones into his arms and hurried into the street, prying her hands from his neck. He swayed under the open air, his knees threatening to give out under him. But he had to turn back. He gulped down fresh air, blinking away the darkness before turning back to the angry, orange mouth of Spindrift. Arthi couldn't hold off the plodders on her own. He couldn't be afraid of his home, of his everything. One foot in front of the other, he made it to the doors before an explosion shook the street, and Spindrift went up in flames.
44. Arthi.
The tick, tick, tick of Arthi's pocket watch echoed between her ribs. 1 second the flames were small and taunting from the shadows, insignificant in the face of her hunger, gasping and tumbling into ashes. The next, her ears rang with a sound. Arthi had been so careful, so meticulous, and her careful planning was what had ruined everything. She yanked her knife out of someone's spine and holstered her pistol. The walls shook and trembled, and as she begged them to hold, to be strong, to keep going, my loves, keep going, they gave up. They gave up, and after all these years, some part of her did the same. Splinters flew, glass shattered, the world's wrath came. A reminder that she was a little girl playing at something too big for her to hold. She had tried, though. She had tried so, so hard. And for what? Her life unraveled as she watched, because of a single act of defiance. Because that was the nature of man. Born to nurture, determined to destroy. Fitting, Arthi thought. At least Jin wasn't here and this nightmare returned. All her life, she'd spun a slow dance through a burning room, and the inferno had caught up to her at last.
45. Jin.
Ashes never really went away. A fire doused was a fire in slumber, waiting for its next feast, its next unsuspecting mark. Jin had thought nothing could compare to how helpless and hopeless he'd felt a decade ago. Spindrift was the culmination of half his existence. Blood, sweat, tears, laughter and anger. Home in every way the estate on Emerald Grove was not. That was the home that had been given to him. This was the one he had made himself, with the family he had chosen for himself. One day, you're going to need to face that fear of yours, Arthi had said years ago. Jin had been annoyed. Why? Because you can't afford the weakness. He hadn't spoken to her for days after that. Not everything needed conquering. But now he saw that she was right. That this weakness could cost him her life. Bystanders were beginning to gather. Toffs pointing fingers from afar. Gangs snickering from the shadows. No one offered to help. Jin kicked open the doors. Smoke charged at him. A horror without fangs. Worse than one awoken from a grave. It gripped him in invisible shackles. Held him hostage beneath an invisible pistol. Yellow. Orange. Red. Red. His breath was coming out in tiny rasps. He gripped the doorframe.
Arthi!
Jin yelled. The banister he had leaned against day after day to watch the dance and flurry of Spindrift groaned and collapsed, taking with it some piece of his heart. The walls were scorched black. Those beautiful dangling orbs had all shattered, swaying like abandoned souls. He was suddenly overcome with wrath. He had never known such rage as he did now. It lit him up inside. It swallowed his panic and his fear, if only for a moment, and gave him strength. He sidestepped a line of plodder corpses and fallen teapots and searched behind the counter, but saw no sign of Arthi. Most of the tables had toppled, but no one alive lay beneath any of them. He tucked his nose under his collar and powered onward. It was easier not to think of what the fire was doing to him. No, it was not easy. It was impossible.
Arthi!
Jin called again. He couldn't summon anything more. The Siwang residence was astronomical. How could he find her in time? No, this was Spindrift. This was home. Embers floated down onto his clothes, and Jin slapped them off in a fit of panic. Panic. Panic had wound through his muscles, and, like a string pulled taut, he could no longer move.
Arthi,
he said uselessly. He could barely hear himself. Smoke clogged his throat, and he broke into a series of coughs. His eyes were watering. His lungs burned.
Where are you?
Stop thinking, he told himself. A thud echoed from the direction of the stairs. A shuffle that couldn't be an act of the fire. The panic eased, allowing him to move. He skirted past more fallen bodies and broken chairs. Arthi's voice a chant in his head that changed to Flick's when she twitched that lighter. And there in the gloom, he saw Mauve. Jin ran. Arthi was trapped under the remnants of a bookcase, slowly prying herself free. She looked up at his approach, soot on her skin, determination sharp on her jaw. By the time he reached her, she had shoved the bookcase off and risen to her feet. She said something, her voice bubbling as if underwater. Spindrift darkened impossibly, and Arthi stumbled, reaching blindly and swaying from the heat. Jin rushed closer and lifted her into his arms. He couldn't breathe. Why couldn't he breathe? His head throbbed. Sound. Fire. A nightmare of memory. Something swayed above Jin. Wicked knives. That was the second story. He leaped out the way of the collapsing stair rail, but not before it struck his back. Arthi went limp, impossibly heavier in his arms. He squeezed his eyes closed for a beat and saw Flick, vividly alive and unafraid, a queen in her gown sculpted from a piece of the unblemished sky. She was sunshine in a bottle, and he was a storm in a boy, drawn to clear skies, reaching for her hand. Just a little farther, she told him. Just a little farther. And then Jin collapsed.